Hassan is 24 years old. He lives in the north of England. He and I met on our Discord server. He's into tech, and he and I had conversations about several things before the record button was hit on this podcast. And in this particular episode, we speak about anxiety, depression, how to optimize your thought patterns, how to become the limitless version of yourself. It was a very intimate discussion. It meant in the most platonic way, and it was full of revelations for the both of us. And this is a very, very special feature, and this particular episode is very, very close to my heart. When men were men. Now, as part of this actual episode, there are a few things that you should know in advance. Number one, unfortunately, I'm still suffering from long COVID. The initial infection is now over, but I'm still suffering the effects of it. So there are parts of the podcast where I'm coughing. And unfortunately, if I delete the cough, then I also delete the other side of the conversation. I did my very best to keep the coughing down to the minimum, put my mic on mute as much as I could. But in many places, unfortunately, I'm really sorry, it was unavoidable. So number two, as I said, there was a couple of hours of conversation that took place before this podcast got recorded, before the record button was hit. And there are a couple of things that come up in conversation, which you might feel like lack a little bit of context. So I'll explain those here. So one of those was talking about a taxi firm. There's a taxi firm in Blackburn that was telling all the customers that they only have to pay £2 an hour, regardless of the length of the journey. The distance of the journey, and that was forcing taxi drivers to work around the clock just to make their money. And so that is the background context to when that conversation comes up, because it was forcing the men to work harder just to make the money. And the other one was a conversation about where I was explaining about how I've been picking my son up from daycare recently in the last couple of weeks, and there's been less traffic on the roads. And we're living in a world now where people don't notice that. They don't realize that there is meaning in that. Oh, actually, there's less traffic on the roads because people are on holiday. The schools are closed because the kids are on holiday, and so on and so on. And it's just about taking meaning from that rather than using necessarily the news as a source of the mainstream media as a source of news. Or, you know, you don't have to be a traffic expert to know that something has changed, or that this is what the cause of this something is. So there were a couple of conversations that were referenced. Most of that conversation can be understood. The rest of the majority, in fact, of the conversation can be understood in a standalone context, because before we were talking about many other topics like Romania and the fall of the Soviet Union and tech and so many other things. So I only really wanted to hit the record button when we started talking about separation and gathering, the heart, the nafs, the ruh, those kind of things. So this is what I wanted to speak to you about. So I have been through a lifetime of this kind of stuff, like looking into, I've looked into how to, let me explain. So first I kind of went to, I didn't look into what does Islam say about these things, right? So I just went to the normal stuff like, okay, psychology and self-help, and all that kind of stuff, you know, even looked into like what herbs can do for you or medications or whatever. And then, you know, and I'm talking over a period of like 2 decades, mm-hmm. right? And then I moved on to, okay, well, what does Islam say about it? Then I learned about, you know, I looked at like trauma, how do you release trauma, NLP, emotional freedom techniques, cognitive behavioral therapy, whole host of stuff, right? I went through all of the stuff that you can think of near enough. And even stuff that I haven't tried, I've at least read about it or looked into it enough. Like, you know, I've actually spoken to somebody or had somebody speak to me to say, okay, I've tried this thing like, you know, psilocybin or ayahuasca or whatever you call it. I don't know how to pronounce that. And this is what it did for me, right? And I looked into all of those things. And then I started looking into, okay, well, what's Islam's answer on how is trauma made? How is it released? How do you deal with depression? How do you deal with anxiety? How do you deal with like narcissism and blah, 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 and all of this kind of stuff. And fast forward to this year, right? So
having, despite having gone through all of that massive journey, spoken to loads of people, I've got a lot of personal experience in helping people because of my work in business strategy and behavioral strategy and all this kind of stuff. In the end, there was a book written by somebody called Sidi Ali Al-Jamal. He was a sheikh, and he wrote a book. He was one of the sheikh in Morocco, and he wrote a book in Arabic, and he used to teach it to the people that used to come to this masjid. And that book remained there, written in Arabic for 200 years. There was only one copy of it. And then 200 years later, there was a copy that was made of it. And that was then trans I wouldn't say it was translated into English necessarily. It was kind of transliterated. It's not even that neither of those two descriptions are purely accurate, because it was translated, but it was translated quite poorly. It's almost a transliteration. The interpretation is poor. It's quite literal. It misses a lot of the nuance. But in the foreword that was written about that book, the sheikh that wrote about that book, and this was a man of huge influence, right? This was somebody that had been in Hollywood and in the BBC and all these places, and he knew some very, very famous. He knew Prince Philip, and he was friend. He was a high society man, and he became Muslim, and he had like thousands of people following him by the time he died. And he was a. I mean, I had met this man before he passed away, and he was a true, true man of Allah. And he said that this book is the most important book that's written by man, right? So we're not talking about what's written. Obviously, the Quran is different and those kind of things. And the reason why he said that is that this book is about the science of transformation, right? How does a human being transform themselves, right? From being this kind of animalistic, passive, gathered kind of just flung around individual, like what we were speaking about at the beginning of the conversation before I started this recording, to being somebody who becomes, almost like superhuman, is fearless, doesn't have the anxiety, is very creative, becomes limitless, like the movie where you take the NZT tablet, right? I can't remember what it was called. I don't know if you see. Have you seen that movie?
Limitless.
Yeah, with Bradley Cooper. I can't remember what the chemicals, NZT or something, right? So you become that person. And this book actually explains how to do that, right? So it's a thick book. It's expensive. It's not even cheap, and it actually explains how do you actually become that human being. And actually, the book is actually about the tasawwuf, which is a completely it's actually a mandatory requirement of being a Muslim, but we've forgotten this. So we think everything is all about the Sharia, which is the outward ritual aspect of things. But there is something called tasawwuf. Tasawwuf is learning to manage the heart. It's the management of the heart. And it's an actual thing that we're supposed to do. But the difference between tasawwuf and Sharia, right? So everything that is taught to us about Sharia, right, that can be taught via textbook as well. So you can say, right, Dhuhr is 4 rakats and Asr is 4 rakats and Maghrib is 3 rakats. You can transmit that information factually, okay? And you can show somebody a ritual. So you can say to somebody, okay, when you do this is how you do ruku, you bend down. This is how you do sajda, you put your head on the floor. So you can teach these things ritually, right? Even all the muamalat stuff. The stuff about dinar and dirham, you can transmit that factually speaking. It's just content. The tasawwuf is not transmitted factually. It's not transmitted in an intellectual matter. The tasawwuf is something that you have to learn intuitively. So you can show somebody how to ride a bike, right? You can show them this is the seat, this is the handlebar, these are the pedals, right? And you sit on the bike like this, and then you can show them, look, you pedal forward like this. But that person is not going to be able to get on that bike and learn how to ride a bike immediately. They have to figure it out for themselves. It's an intuitive knowledge, right? And it has to be transmitted heart to heart. It's not something that's transmitted in the books. But it's captured in that book in the sense that because that book is actually written for the sheikh, so that they can use that book to then actually explain it to the people. And only a sheikh who's mastered tasawwuf is a sheikh that can teach it to other people, right? Because if you just talk about tasawwuf and you've never learned it, is you can't learn. You can say to somebody, even if you haven't prayed Asr yourself, you never prayed Dhuhr, you never prayed Asr. Somebody says to you, "Well, Asr is 4 rakats." You can transmit that information to the other person, and they will know that you'll be correct in transmitting that. Okay, Asr is 4 rakats. Tasawwuf you cannot transmit in that way. You can't say to somebody, if you haven't not ridden a bike, you will not be able to teach somebody how to ride a bike. you won't be able to do it. So the fundamental learning in this book, the book is about tasawwuf, and tasawwuf is what transforms a human being. The fundamental concept in this book is about separation and gathering, right? It's learning to master the nafs and understanding what separation means, understanding what gathering means, understanding what majesty means, and understanding what beauty means. And then understanding how the nafs is related to the heart, understanding how the heart is related to the ruh, right? And what the ruh is. And when you understand all of these things, you then understand how do you learn to transform yourself. And I've been learning this stuff this year after everything that I've been through, right? Ramadan of this year, I started learning how to do this and I was getting it proper wrong. I could not figure it out. And then eventually I had a slight little bit breakthrough, then a bit more and then a bit more. And now I'm learning how to do it. And this thing, hand on heart, I can tell you, trumps everything. It trumps psychology. It trumps CBT, NLP. It trumps Ayakusa, LSD, psilocybin, everything. It trumps everything because it goes straight to the source, which is the heart and how you connect it to Allah. And then the light of Allah basically transforms your heart. And that's what gets rid of the anxiety and the depression and everything. And it just completely changes. It gets rid of the fear of creation, the fear of this, the fear of that. It just all goes away and you become an elevated human being. And that's right. How you do it, right? So you can tell me if you're getting bored and you can tell me if I'm overwhelming you.
I'm fascinated. Yeah. So okay. I can listen. I'm very good at it.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm giving you the option. You have to understand the terms, right? So you have to understand the state of the heart first. So I'm transmitting to you what's been taught to me by my sheikh, and this book has been used as the reference. Okay, because this book, if you try and read this book on your own, it will not make any sense.
Okay.
I've not been allowed to read the book. I've only been allowed to read a couple of pages here and there. And it's not an elitism thing, right? It's not about that. It's just right. Because it's not going to make any sense to me. That's why.
I see.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. So, yeah. So first you have to understand the heart. So what my sheikh taught me is the heart, the nafs, and the ruh, they're essentially the same thing. They are, but they are dimensions of each other, right? So you can be, if your nafs is dominant, then your heart is not dominant. And so when the nafs is dominant, the nafs has got veils in there. So veils are, they're covers on our perceptions. So that's what causes anxieties, depression, because we can't see the beauty in something, right? We can't see the goodness in something. It veils us from it, right? So we see bad in everything. We see terror in everything. We see darkness in everything. It's because the nafs is veiling all of that, right? So the bigger the nafs is, the more veils we have. And the more we can't see, we can't understand ourselves, the more we do things that are hurting other people, but we blame them for them being hurt and for hurting us, even though they're just reacting to us. Right, yeah. So that's what the nafs leads to that. But when the nafs is lowered completely, and you can't completely destroy it, but when it's completely lowered, and you have the heart on its own, the heart effectively just becomes the ruh, and then you're as perfect a human being as you can be, and so you are in love with Allah, you don't fear anything, you don't have veils, you can just look at something and you can understand things. Your perception is really, really far and wide. Your cognitive ability is just, you're limitless, basically. In the metaphorical sense, you are limitless. Yeah?
Question. Does this mean that by having tawassuf, or is it tasawwuf? Sorry, to have tasawwuf actually increases the strength of your tawakkul?
Yes, but tasawwuf is not to have tasawwuf. Tasawwuf is a practice. When you are somebody that does tasawwuf, right? You're somebody that rides a bike.
It's a verb, yes.
Yeah, tasawwuf is a science, right? Okay. So people who do tasawwuf, they're called Sufis, but that term has been corrupted, right? To mean something else, yeah. Right? Like a blacksmith, right, is somebody that forges an iron bar, right? It's just a Sufi. A Sufi was not supposed to be a sect. A Sufi is somebody that practices tasawwuf. That's all that was supposed to mean.
See.
That's where Sufi comes from, but it's been corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is a science, right? Right. And so, yeah, it does. Your courage increases because it increases your tawakkul. Now, this is what you have to understand about the nafs. So these are where the terms now come in. The nafs is gathered outwardly by default, by design. When you are born, the nafs is gathered outwardly. And what that means is when you are gathered to something, right, you are in need of it. You are clung to it, right? Okay. And you fear the loss of it, right? You're really afraid to let it go. So when we say that the nafs is gathered outwardly, what we mean is outside of our soul, mm-hmm. right? So everything that's outside of our soul, which includes the body even, right? Outside of the heart. So the body and everything outside, the air, the food, the people, the love, the validation, the everything. The nafs is gathered outwardly, as in it's in need of all of those things.
Okay.
Right? So it's gathered towards them, right?
Right.
And so what we have to learn with the nafs, to when you're doing tasawwuf, the first, I mean, there's a lot to tasawwuf, but the most fundamental concept when it comes to tasawwuf is you have to go through the learning to manage the heart, because the human being can actually manage his heart. They can actually make the heart move. You can actually make it move. You can actually tell it to stop being anxious. You can actually tell it to be more braver. You can tell it to stop being in pain. There's a lot of, you can actually tell it to do so. You can command it, right? So the ruh can actually do that. You can train yourself to actually do those things, which I've been learning. I'm not by any means a master at this. I'm learning it. Uh-huh. And this is what all of us as Muslims, we're supposed to learn how to do. Uh-huh. So what you do is you separate it outwardly. So what that means is you close your eyes. You can do this right now. You close your eyes and you don't do this with your head. You go into your heart and you say, right, I am going to separate from my outward. So from my body, from needing food, from air, all these things, right? I'm going to separate from, you could do it with your heart. I'm going to separate from all that. I'm not going to gather to all of this. I'm going to separate from all of it. I'm not in need of any of these things. Right. Uh-huh. And then what you do is you gather inwardly. And what is meant by that is in your heart, you gather towards Allah inwardly. So you say, right, it's just me and you. I am only in need of you, Allah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And what that does, it creates a state of inward beauty. So beauty means something that you're drawn to. So you're drawn to Allah. You're like, you're so intoxicated by Him. You're so drawn to Him. You're so just in awe of Him, enamored by Him and all that. And then outwardly, what you have is majesty. And majesty means like mastery. You become a master of your body. You become a master of your response to things. Like things don't terrorize you. They don't cause you anxiety. You are in charge of how you perceive stuff. So nothing bothers you. Nothing phases you.
Mm-hmm.
And you just do that exercise every single day. And that's only separation and gathering. And you just do it and you just keep doing it. And then there are other things that you can do after that as well. But that's the first thing that you start with. And that beats everything. Everything.
So this is actually quite interesting. Because the term you said or the phrase you said regarding how you can command the heart. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but there's a thing known as, I think it's broken heart syndrome.
Yes.
Where to the point where just by having a broken heart in terms of emotionally, it is enough to cause physical defects within the heart and a physical impact within the heart. So again, by doing what you're saying and regarding whether you can command the body and specifically the heart in that way, that is the case. By separating your body from the heart.
Yes.
Does that create by separating that, it protects the heart, right? Because you're separating it from everything else which causes the harm. Would that be correct?
If you want to speak in, I mean, it can be a little bit, when I say dangerous, I don't mean like bid'ah and those kind of dangerous or toxic or corrupt or evil, but it can be a little bit dangerous to speak in these terms. But because I know you're like a physics kind of guy, I'll speak in these terms for now because it will help. But what you're doing is you're separating your heart from the outside world, right? You're separating your nafs from the outside world. You're separating away from it and you're gathering inwardly towards Allah.
Uh-huh.
In that moment, what is taking place is you're bringing more light into the heart. So you're bringing more chi or more electromagnetic energy into it. Right. And you're reviving it. You're bringing it to life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the source of life is Allah anyway. He's the source of creation.
Yeah, of course.
So why not go back to the source?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I was just talking about the effect is having.
You could reverse it, definitely.
I'm not saying that by thinking in a physical, because I understand spiritual or metaphysical cannot be understood by physics. There are certain things which are metaphysical, which no matter how much physics you have or how many words you try and describe it with, or how much physics you try and describe it with, it's impossible. So the only thing what I was trying to say is that the effect and just to show that the world can have an impact upon the heart. So it's not something that it sounds silly, since the world can affect the heart in such a physical way, just by proximity to a problem, so to speak. Then by separating the heart from the world, not only is it protecting the heart, but then you're taking it, you're almost presenting the heart to its creator and saying, here.
That's exactly what you're doing. And you're enlivening it in the process. That's what he wants you to do. You have to master the nafs in this way. There's more to this journey, but this is the fundamental first step that you have to do.
That's fascinating. So then would you say that being in the masjid is almost like being in a place where the heart, the distance between the heart and the Lord, so to speak, is much smaller because it's a house of Allah. It has extra proximity, so to speak.
It probably will have. I know that I was told that in doing this exercise, this is an actual exercise where you actually close your eyes and do it, right? I was told that it's more amplified in Ramadan, and I did find that it was more amplified, and I also find that doing it during the day is nowhere near as potent as doing it at night, and the later that I do it at night, the more potent it is. And then I'm saying that experientially. I'm not saying that based on like.
And would you say that doing it during the night is as you get closer to the time of the Hajj?
Yes, way more. But don't let that put you off doing it whenever. Do it whenever you can.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so that's the thing. People put rules on it.
The whole world has become so ritualistic. Yeah, yeah. It's just become ridiculous. And this process of tasawwuf, it's not about there is more to it, but it's not about the rituals you're doing in the outward. It's your world inside you. It's what's going on in there. It's what that journey looks like.
Yeah, I understand.
And there's a whole world of meaning over there. And I'll tell you one thing. If when you try and do it, like when I did it in the beginning, I kept doing it with my head, and I kept trying to do it, and I just couldn't figure it out. Because you're not supposed to do it with your head, you're supposed to do it with your heart. And just being aware of what the heart is and knowing that you can command it and all that just sounded so weird to me. Right? And I just didn't... But when you learn how to do it, and then you have to learn to get better at it, it gets really interesting. And one thing that I realized was, if you get even an atom's worth of intimacy with Allah, even an atom's worth, right? So, to speak in technical terms, you know, like on a phone or like on a Linux operating system, you know what they do is, like on a phone, what they do sometimes is they go, all right, we're issuing you a firmware update. You get a firmware. It's not a software update. It's a firmware update.
Yes.
A firmware update. There's nothing changes. Nothing changes on the phone itself, right? So the apps stay the same. The colors stay the same. There's no new features. Nothing's happened. But under the hood, there's been a little bit of firmware update that's just made it a teeny bit more stable, you know, a little bit better in terms of battery usage, a little bit better in terms of security attacks and all that kind of stuff. And it's just a tiny little firmware update. And what happens is, they did this with Linux. There was a series of firmware updates that were done over the years. The really, really, really tiny little firmware updates. And it just became this really solid, absolutely solid operating system that hardly ever crashes. It just runs and runs and runs, like unlike Windows, which is like really buggy and all this, and it's really stable, but on the outside it's not very pretty, it's not very featureful and all that, right? But the core of it is just really, 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 really solid,
which is why it's used everywhere so to speak,
which is why it's actually running the internet. It runs the world. It's not Windows that runs the world, it's Linux. And what happens is when you if you can, I mean, you can achieve a lot more than an atom's worth. But if you can only manage an atom's worth of intimacy with Allah, you will get in that moment when you'll know when you've had an atom's worth of intimacy. In that moment, you will have received a firmware update and you won't even know it's happened. And you keep doing it every single day. And before you know it, within a month, you've gone from like a firmware update that's been versioned up by 0.001. Right, you do that 20 times, and now it's like you've gone up by 0.1 in terms of the version numbers.
Yeah.
You get what I'm saying?
Fascinating. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
You just keep doing it. And I've noticed so much difference in like my relationship with my son, with my wife, with society, with my perception of things, with things that used to trigger me before, but what triggers me now, my stress response, my health. And because I've been doing it since Ramadan now, so how many months has it been since Ramadan? It's been about 4 months altogether, maybe.
Yeah, something like that.
April, May, June, July. Yeah, 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
I understand. One time I did something which was it was an experiment, and it was just to pray namaz. I think it was Isha namaz. I always do it at Isha namaz because I feel very centered during Isha namaz. What I did was I prayed extremely slowly, and as much of Surah Fatiha, and as much as I knew the translation of, I would read the ayah, of course, in Arabic. Then I would ponder on the translation just for a second and accept the translation for what it is.
Oh, fantastic!
So, all praise be to Allah, and then I would just ponder on that for a second, and then Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim. You know what I mean? So the most beneficial, and I would ponder on that. Like, you know what?
Yeah, yes. You accepted it into your heart, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So that's very powerful, because then you are programming yourself.
Yeah.
To actually be on the Sirat al-Mustaqim, to be one of those that's not gone astray, and you've actually programmed yourself in that moment.
So this is why it was extremely important to know. For the Arabs, they knew the meaning because it was their language. But it's important for us to know the meaning of it so that we can accept it for what it is.
But this is the thing, you've got an entire demographic of Arabs, and they know the language, and it still hasn't changed them.
But you have to do. You have to accept it, though. So as much as knowing what it means, and accepting what it means into your heart is two different things.
Yeah, right? But the point that I'm making is because a lot of people go, right, I want to become religious, so I'm going to learn Arabic so I can understand what I'm reading. It's not a guarantee, because you've got a million, more than a million, millions of Arabs who can understand what is being said, and it hasn't done anything for them.
So because again,
it's about the heart. It's about the state of the heart. Yeah. It's what you do with the heart that matters.
Yeah. So I agree with that. I guess it comes down to the idea of amal over ilm. So even if you have a bit of knowledge, but you really implement it to its fullest, that's way more powerful than having loads of knowledge and not implementing a single ounce of it. So for me, that namaz that day took about 45 minutes, and it felt like 2 minutes, honestly. It felt like no time at all. And it was really fascinating, because one thing I noticed after doing that, and the next day specifically, is I had more time in the day.
Yeah.
And when I say this, it's not like a gimmick or anything like that, but it's almost like
that's your quantum state changes, because the heart operates on a quantum level, so your quantum state changes.
Yeah, so
your perception of time changes.
It's almost like getting a watch that is out of time and getting it recalibrated. That's what it felt like to me. And I feel like, technically speaking, we get that opportunity 5 times a day.
Yeah.
If you choose to do it correctly, so again, a ritual, doing it for the sake of doing it, as opposed to doing it for what its purpose was, and the idea of not just doing it because it's a ritual, but doing it with purpose and intent. I think that's where it comes into. That's actually quite fascinating. So yeah, inshallah, I am going to try that.
I'm available for questions as well, because hopefully, because some people that I've told about it, Some have kind of gone, oh, that's interesting, and they've not done anything with it. Some have kind of tried it but not known how to move forward. And the thing is, because I'm not the ultimate teacher here, because I've been learning it for myself. It's just that I'm a little tiny bit further down the line.
Yeah.
So what I can share, I will, but I only know so much myself as well. But I've been learning it experientially myself, and I've been sharing it with, you know, whoever I'm learning it with.
Yeah, I've always looked towards these things because I understand the benefit of it. I used to do meditation where I used to, I guess, silence the heart, so to speak, in terms of silence everything.
Well, silence the head.
Silence the head in terms of, I used to silence the head. I don't know if that was my way of trying to get away from everything.
But that's what you got to do. That's what you're going to do in this exercise as well.
So I managed to do that very well.
You'd be in need of Allah inwardly with your heart. If you're in need of Him inwardly in your heart, you've got it. Because you can do it one of two ways. You can either separate outwardly, and that will lead to inward gatheredness, or you can gather inwardly, which will lead to outward separation.
I see. Oh, that makes sense. So when I did that, even just that exercise, I used to be able to slip into it whenever, like on command. So if something's happening around me that is a bit intense, I'd close my eyes, slip into it, and I don't need to be in it for long. It would have its impact. This method.
Let me tell you something that you might not know about yourself. The reason, speaking to you, I genuinely felt like you were much older. I thought you were like one of these guys, like married with kids and all that kind of stuff, right? But the schooling and your experiences and everything obviously all contribute, but you will be surprised that the probably the thing that's had the biggest impact on giving you that kind of inward maturity, perception of the world and everything, will be those one or two exercises that you've done in that way. That's what's done it for you, because you could be wondering what do you attribute that to? Do you attribute it to your schooling, to your upbringing, to your society, or whatever? It's not any of those things, because there are many other people. There'll be a number of people around you that have gone through the same track of life as you. What it actually comes down to is the exercise that you've done, and so you keep doing it, and you realize what it's going to do for you, give you the knowledge of a man of 1,000 years.
Okay.
Because the source of knowledge is Allah as well, right? He is the creator of knowledge.
Sorry, I got a bit excited because I was reading a book called Psycho-Cybernetics. I don't know if you've ever read it.
I hate that book. I'm sorry. I hate that book.
But the interesting bit, okay, so I understand what you're saying, but it talks about a concept regarding there being like a one source of all knowledge, and you're just plucking from it.
Yeah,
so to speak.
But that source is Allah, right?
Yes. So that's the exact same thing that I thought. I was like, but that source is Allah. What they're talking about, man?
Yeah. So the knowledge, you know, what really annoys me when people say to me, the hadith is seek knowledge even if you have to go to China. Now, whether that hadith is true or not, right? The point is that people use that to justify, you know, going to every end to get a degree and all this kind of stuff, but that's those things are not the source. You watch that that what I put up in the watch list, the Operation Varsity Blues. It's only about an hour and a half. It's about the college admission scandal, and you realize the universities are not the source of knowledge at all. They're a source of prestige. They're a source of status. Yeah. That's all they are.
So if
Allah is the source of knowledge because He created knowledge, right? And then if you're connecting your heart to Him, you're getting a direct link of knowledge going straight into your heart.
Yeah.
That's a direct feed. You cannot get a more pure, authentic source.
Oh, yeah, an organic source. It's like the most organic source of knowledge.
And then what happens is you, everything gets a lot more meaning all of a sudden, right? So this thing, I know I only started to record it for the benefit of people that are listening to this. We had a much more extensive conversation before this recording, but it was a more general chat. But now, this specifically, I'm recording this about separation gathering. But we were speaking about, you know, like somebody who sits in their car and doesn't realize why there's less traffic on the road all of a sudden, and doesn't attribute it to the fact that, you know, it's summer holidays and the kids are off school and a lot of people have gone on holiday abroad. That's why there's less traffic. Is because they can't see the meaning in things. They just see everything as machinations. Everything's just, it's all nihilist, right? It's just, everything is just meaningless. Everything is just physical objects and things.
Yeah.
But this this process teaches you to be, it basically brings the meaning out in everything.
Mm-hmm. It's being present on another level.
Yeah, and you'll be surprised how far that can go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
It can go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper.
I would, because of my experience when I did the normal version or the let's say less religious version, which was just the idea of not thinking of anything. From knowing the benefit I had, and even though I've stopped doing it, which is ridiculous, knowing the benefit that I got from it at the time, and how it did help me through whatever I was going through at the time, I was able to. Anytime something would come towards me that was unsettling to my...
You were unfazed by it.
I was able to... And honestly, it was a matter of closing my eyes, taking one deep breath in, and that was enough for me.
Yeah.
That was it. And the worry kind of got thrown away. I've actually got I got a story that happened once, which was... It was Ramadan 3 years ago. And I was praying Tarawih, and at the time I was, I don't know if I'd started my company or there was something I was doing at the time which required a better laptop than what I had at the time. So I'm sat down and I'm praying namaz, and just between the rakats, it comes into my mind that I need to look for another laptop. But then I just centered myself for a second. I just said, you know what. I'm praying right now, but inshallah, either a brilliant deal will come to me, or I'll have an opportunity to make enough money, and that'll pay for an upgrade. But right now, I'm praying, and I exited it out of my mind immediately. Fantastic. To the point where it wasn't even like at the back of my mind. It was I'm not even going to think about this right now, right? And I believe it was a close enough time to that when I was doing that exercise that I was able to do it fully. Because to be able to control, I guess in this, taking your analogy, which is controlling your heart, but at the time I was thinking I was controlling my mind, but the ability to control what you decide is going to affect it or not, what it did for me, yeah, I was able to get rid of it. But the fascinating thing is, I came home to my father who sat on the sofa. And he was smirking, and he asked me, and I'd never talked to him about getting another laptop, but he asked me, yeah, so it's even crazier than that, is, yeah, he goes to me, were you looking for a laptop? And I was shocked at first, and I was like, what are you on about? And he goes, if you go to the car, underneath the seat, there's a laptop. Now, my father smokes, unfortunately, but what had happened is, whilst I was at Tarawih, I think, and he'd gone for a smoke or something, and I think he was praying at home at the time. But he'd gone to go get some cigarettes from the store, and somebody had come up to him who maybe needed a bit of money. I don't know what their condition was, but was selling a laptop. And he picked up at the time, which was a laptop that was probably worth about £600. He picked up for £25.
Oh my God!
Right?
Are you sure it wasn't stolen?
I'm not sure whether it was stolen or not, and I'm not sure. And my dad being my dad, he haggled him down to £22. Which is probably the highlight.
Well,
of the
situation. It still landed in your lap, though, didn't it?
It landed in my lap. It was, and the thing is, the takeaway from it is, it's not meant to be instant. Even though it was instant for me in that moment, it was literally the proximity in time.
It's your material reward for having gathered yourself towards Allah. And the thing is, the key is not to. Okay, I'm going to do this exercise because I'm going to get more material reward, because that completely defeats the purpose, right? Completely defeats the point.
Mm-hmm.
But these things are there to encourage you to keep doing it.
Yeah. So although I was very lucky in this case to have an immediate effect, one thing we've got to realize is you're not always going to get an immediate effect, and maybe the effect that you're asking for, the actual beneficial effect, is for nothing to happen. So there was something else worse lined up for you, but that's not going to happen now. And there's also a blessing within that. So it's a matter of...
The ultimate thing is that you get a quote-unquote firmware update, that you raise yourself in your understanding of the world. What needs to happen is your understanding should increase. And that's what was supposed to be meant by knowledge. Knowledge is not supposed to be rote memorization, just acquiring more facts. Knowledge is supposed to be more increasing your understanding of things.
Yes, because every piece of knowledge that I'm assuming, I don't know whether everybody has this, but what I tend to do is when another piece of knowledge comes towards me, I always look to link it to, like, most things can be linked to knowledge which is not even within the same field. I tend to do it tech related. So what I find is that sometimes seeing analogies between certain things, between tech, is easier for me. But knowledge is a web that connects to each other. It's not a doctor is just a doctor and he deals with the body, but knowledge of the nafs also connects to the knowledge of the body and so on and so forth. So
Well, that's what the Chinese medicine system says. So the lungs are connected to the large intestine. So if you're looking at what's going on in the stomach, you can't ignore the lungs, because the large intestine, I can't remember which way around it is, but I think the large intestine are the bowels of the lungs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get an infection in your lungs, it ends up in your stomach. So if you've got a stomach ache, it might not actually be related to the stomach. It could actually be related to the lungs.
That's fascinating. Right?
So, then like your bladder meridian runs all the way from your foot all the way to your head. So if you've got a headache, it could actually be something to do with your bladder, for example.
I see. And
the whole world works this way. The entire world works
precisely
in this interconnected kind of way.
So again, like talking about how, for example, a prime example of this is that, and I guess you could call it a butterfly effect. Everything has a butterfly effect. Meaning, for example, that taxi firm that I was talking about in Accrington, because they had not increased their price to something that was meant to be standard within the industry, and they kept their prices too low so that the people could not earn, what the knock-on effect of this was is that people were working for longer to earn a living wage, right? And because they were working for longer, they were no longer giving time to the children. And now what's happened is now you're seeing those same children running amok on the streets, because they never no longer had that connection with the parents. Yeah. A lot of people don't notice that butterfly effect.
Yeah, and everybody could be saying, oh, you know, the reason why these children are running amok because the parents didn't raise them properly, or society or whatever. Like, actually, no, there's a taxi company that's to blame for these children.
Yeah.
You could never go out into public and say there's a taxi company that's responsible for what's going on with these kids.
Yeah. And in this case, it genuinely is the case. Like I was speaking to one of these taxi drivers and I was trying to understand, he was saying that I'm taking this much money a week, X amount of money a week. But I said to him, but how many hours have you given up? How long has it been since you last seen your child? Like kind of thing. So of course, if you've worked that many hours, even if you go home at the time your child is at home, are you going to be willing to engage with them? Do you have the energy?
You're too knackered.
Yeah. So again, just taking this into consideration as well, is that because people are in the rat race of a 9-to-5 and they're working jobs which are stressing them out and they're not taking care of themselves mentally, what's happening is that the masjids have now actually become babysitting. So when you send your child to the madrasa, I had a parent come into the shop today, and he said to so the shop owner, he has his own madrasa. He's a hafiz, and he just became an alim. And the parent goes, when are you going to start masjid again? Because these kids are home and they're just running amok.
It's not about what the kids learning there. It's just because they just want them to be taken care of.
Yeah. So what I said to him is that if anything, we should be having more holidays, because this guy needs to connect with his children. Because he needs to be able to control them. And then you find a lot of parents now will go to ustads and say, listen, can you put some sense into this kid, right? Which is the opposite,
which is supposed to be their responsibility. They're supposed to learn how to do this.
But then what happens is,
you know, I've had children very, very late in my life, right? I had my first child, he was a COVID baby. He was born in October of 2020, when I was 40.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you what, like the last 2 years, what they have taught me, there's been so much meaning in this. And I think it's really increased my respect of a lot of parents. But then at the same time, like you tell me stories like this, and I think to myself, what a missed opportunity. Like, this has taught me so much about, because you learn so much from because you could, the child is still developing, you understand so much about the child.
Yeah.
You understand the nature of a human being. It really, really helps you.
It's
really, really helps you. And there's so many people out there because they're so spent in their careers and so spent on building up their houses and the extensions and the extra roof and getting that Audi Q7 and the flipping work, make, you know, saving up to buy a Ferrari 458 or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and that, those beach holidays and everything. They've not taken advantage of this this a wonderful learning experience.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. I agree with that 100%. I've not had kids yet. I've not had kids yet, so I've not had that opportunity.
Well, but you're going to do an amazing job. I can tell you this. I can tell you this right now.
I was worried about it. Like, the idea of being a good father worried me as a probably when I, but from the age of 15, I realized that I've got to build my character now.
Yes.
To be in a position to be a good father one day. Because, and especially keeping the friends that I had then, that was going to impact, again, the butterfly effect of whoever I was friends with when I was in high school is going to be massive upon how I am a father.
Well, if you keep going the way that you're going right now, I can assure you, you'll do an amazing job, inshallah. I'll tell you something very personal. For me, because of when this child was born, COVID and, you know, lockdowns and my age and, you know, because, you know, you have less stamina at this age and environment and what's going on in the economy and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It has been a very testing time, mm-hmm. but the one thing that has really helped me in all of this stuff, like my relationship, even though my son has not even hit two yet, and up till Ramadan, my relationship about 6 months before that, so after his first birthday, my relationship with him was really starting to go downhill,
right?
And I could feel it and I could sense it and I could see it, and because my parenting style was based on whatever I've seen in society. So you be disciplined and you instill fear into the child and you limit their expression and all this kind of stuff, right?
Right.
And it was just deteriorating, and it was a massive source of frustration for me. Massive. And pain as well, obviously. And I've seen this with other people, and you see how they deal with this, right? They just mask themselves, or they start blaming other people or whatever, or they just persist in the way that they're doing it. And then I started in Ramadan, when I started the separation and gathering. So when Ramadan started and I started doing it, and those first 3 weeks, nothing happened for me, right? So which is funny, because everybody that I've personally taught this to, that has wanted to do this, has figured it out way faster than I figured it out.
Right.
They were able to do it better than I was able to do it. It just wasn't working for me for whatever reason. And I would every night after, you know, when it would go dark, Maghrib time, I'd be sat there and I would spend an entire hour trying to get this to work, and nothing would happen. Nothing. And it went on for about 3 weeks. And then in the fourth week, alhamdulillah, in those last 10 days, I finally had this really, really, really tiny breakthrough. Tiny, 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 tiny breakthrough. But I knew, I wasn't 100% sure, but I spoke to my sheikh and he was like, look, that world is a world of meaning, and everything is very, very subtle in the world of meaning. And in the world of meaning, it's a much, in the outward, it might be a very small thing. You know, you had this slight feeling of intimacy or whatever, or you noticed your heart for the first time, or it moved a little bit. Because it can actually physically move. And I don't mean in terms of a heartbeat. Like, you will sense the movement of it, right?
Yeah.
And I had this kind of little taste of inward beauty and stuff like that. And that happened for the first time. And I was like, okay, whatever. Like, oh, that's nice. I've finally achieved something. I don't know how to take this further. And then at that time, my relationship with my son was at like peak tension. Like, he just wasn't interested. He just didn't want to be in the same room as me. And I wasn't even doing anything severe, right? So I wasn't hitting him. I wasn't slapping him. I wasn't screaming at him. I wasn't doing any of these things. But he just always wanted to run to his mom or his grandmother, right? And I felt like, oh, you know, kids, they're all... So I was in this kind of... I was in this kind of narrative of... Sorry?
it's just a phase kind of thing, like, oh, it's just something.
Yeah, that yeah. But yeah. I was in this narrative of not taking responsibility for it, right? So I'm okay. Like, oh, you know, at this age, kids only want their mothers; they don't want their fathers. And because he has more exposure to his mother and his grandmother, that's probably why he doesn't want to hang around with me. And I don't have enough energy to be this with him. And they just understand him better because they're women and blah, blah. No, so I have this whole narrative compiled in my head, right? And then when I started doing this exercise, because one of the things that you have to understand from this exercise is that you have to be in need of Allah inwardly in your heart. So you actually put your heart in a state of need of Allah inwardly, right?
Right.
And you should not be, because when you're gathered to something, you're in need of it. So if you're gathering yourself inwardly, you are in need inwardly, right? So if you are gathered, if the nafs is gathered outwardly, it's in need of things in the outward. It's in need of good health. It's in need of, you know, your body being in a good state. It's in need of company and all that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
So I learned and I understood that I need to not be in need of things outwardly. So I learned, and this is going to sound really counterintuitive and really odd, but I learned not to be in need of him. Because I hadn't realized I was in need of him. I was showing him desperation. Right. So I started doing that. I started just reducing it. Because I learned how to manage my heart, I started learning to reduce that need of him. Right. And as soon as I did that, the next day, I remember going to pick him up. And because you know that what is in the heart is transmitted by the eyes. So I would just take one look at him, he'd take one look at me, and he just wouldn't want to look at me, right? He wouldn't want to engage with me.
All right.
And and I remember the first time when I had this, I closed my eyes, I reduced my need of him, I did this kind of separation and gathering, and I felt like nothing had happened. I kind of felt like, oh, I tried it, but nothing happened. That's kind of how I felt like, right? I gave it a go, but nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it was like an hour later or the next day or whatever, I went up to him and he looked at me. I looked at him and he looked at me back as if to say, oh, his eyes just basically said to me, oh, you're a little bit different now. You're interacting with me a little bit differently now. Mm-hmm. So I will interact. So he didn't actually change his behavior. But even his eye, because he can't speak, so his just eyes told me, oh, I'm going to be you've changed. There's something, you're a different person kind of thing, right? And I thought to myself, oh, that just must be a coincidence, right? So I just kind of, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. Next day, same thing. He looked at me as if to go, oh, you're a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
right? Third day, he started interacting with me with a little bit. And now, and then, so I kept doing it. I kept doing the exercise every day. I kept reducing my need, kept gathering inwardly. And bit by bit, within 4 months now, his relationship with me is completely different. Completely different. He wants to be in the room that I'm in,
mm-hmm.
right? The only person at the moment that can change his nappy without him screaming his head off is me. And I used to be the last person that used to be able to do that.
Uh-huh.
He laughs his head off. He won't sleep. When he's in the bed with me, he won't sleep because he's so excited about chilling out with me. He won't sleep. Right. He just jumps up and down on the bed. And I've had such rewarding experiences with him, between me and him. Yeah, all has just been down to that exercise, right? And so when you tell me the story of what's going on with these men and their children, it's absolutely heartbreaking because... It's heartbreaking because I think I would hate for that to happen with my kid. Mm-hmm. But I just think to myself, imagine what pain they must be in. Because they know it deep down. They must be in so much pain.
They do. Yeah, so that's actually interesting. Yeah. So it's almost like they know it deep down, but because they're too busy dismissing it, it's and they're already distracted. The best example.
Well, actually, the pain has actually now become the source of distraction, because they're now running away from the pain, so they have to do it because they can't deal. They can't address the pain of it.
Precisely. So I think the perfect example is there's a video of a guy called Mo Godat who was a Google engineer, and he has this thing which he calls the algorithm of happiness, where he goes that people go to, for example, parties, and they bombard their brain with just noise and lights and just chaos. And it's so much chaos that their brain becomes silent, so to speak, right? Mm. Because they're not actually observing; they're just taking in. And whilst you're taking in, you don't have thoughts as such. You're just too busy taking information in. So what's happening is that these parents are then just distracting themselves completely and occupying their mind with something else,
mm-hmm.
so that they're not having to feel that pain. Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's just what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. So I think.
I mean, as men especially, I've not noticed this with men, women do it as well, but I've noticed this a lot more with men. Men will run to work because they don't have to face their problems, so okay. They will justify it. They will justify it with. What annoys me the most is, you know, everything's always justified Islamically, right? Well, men are required to protect and provide, so I'm doing it for that reason, and you know, the economy and there's inflation, all this, and I'm not dismissing any of that. I'm not saying men are not supposed to protect and provide, and men are not supposed to work. I'm not saying any. It's not, you know, I'm not being completely black and white. Am I? What I'm saying is, there is a threshold that they exceed, right? Because what they're actually doing is they don't want to have to sit with themselves. They don't want to have to face, because they don't know how to face this stuff, so that they run away from it. And work is a perfect excuse, because this capitalist society rewards that behavior.
So it's easy to do it. Yeah, because you're getting rewarded.
You know, if somebody says to me, I'm working 70 hours a week and I'm doing this and this and this, then I'm like, you know, I'm working so hard, and they want me to celebrate that, I feel the complete opposite.
Yeah. Like, exactly.
So what are you running from?
So again, when they use religion there's a perfect analogy that happened during the Sahaba's time or during the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's time, which is wasn't there a Sahaba that was staying inside the masjid and he wouldn't go home and he would pray all the time? And then the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said to him, go home. You have a duty to your family too.
Yeah, right. I think there was one. I can't remember who it was. It was either Salman Al Farsi, radiallahu anhu, or it was Abdul Rahman ibn Auf, one of the two. And they spent the night with one Sahaba, and then they were like, "Okay, now do your Isha, and then now, you know, do some dhikr, and now go and spend some time with your family. Okay, now go to sleep. Now get up." Like, showed them how to just be in balance.
Right.
You know.
Yes. Yeah, So you can't disregard the duty of being a father or being a parent by using another duty, which is also a duty, but you can't disregard another duty using it, so to speak.
You can't do a justification of it. The problem is that we now live in a world. I mean, a lot of people cannot make ends meet, right? Especially like single mothers. It's very difficult for them to make ends meet without even doing two jobs. Daycare is really expensive, mortgages and everything. So I'm not. You know, they're in a difficult situation. Right, so I'm not talking about those kind of people. It's people that go looking for the extra work and justify it when they don't actually need to. Right, I'm not talking about because we are living in an economy where it's actually very difficult to survive right now.
Well, I agree with that. Yeah.
So you sometimes don't have any choice to do just work around the clock or whatever. But that's not what I'm speaking to. I'm not speaking to that particular those situations. I'm talking about the people that, you know, they could get by, they could do the 9-to-5 and they could still get by, but they just want to do more and more and more. And even if they don't occupy themselves with their work, you know, and they usually do, then it's the side hustle, and then it's the, you know, okay, I'm going to go and support this charity and I'm going to go and do this. And it, all of it is just an excuse to run away from actually, having to deal with these difficult, deal with these difficult situations. That's what it actually is. Men just become submarines. They just completely, they get into that submarine. They just go deep underwater. They don't come back up. They don't need to come back up forever. They just become submarines. And it's incredibly dangerous, because when you then have to deal with something that you are forced to deal with, you can't get away from. They don't have the capacity to do it. They don't know how to deal with it.
It's like the submarines taking on water, but instead of coming up, they stay down. Because it's more comfortable.
They just get flooded. They just suffocate. And I see this all the time, especially with the men. I see this a hell of a lot, and especially of men that are, you know, in the range that's between your age and my age, you see this way too much.
Yeah, I think the generation above us, like for example, first generation migrants from back home, for example, because of the I'm not sure whether it's because society was less noise and less information flow and so on and so forth, and because they had more time to be with themselves, as opposed to just being on YouTube and watching the news and blah, blah, blah. The strength that they had and the family ties that they had with their children and stuff was different.
Yeah. But
because now we have more ways to distract ourselves and more information flow and more noise, it's harder to maintain that balance. Is that something you want agree on?
Yeah, definitely.
It's more of the, it's more of like what you say about, you know, these countries that have, back to the, you know, the countries where the state collapsed, the Soviet Union collapsed, they've actually strengthened their ties between them,
yeah,
and they've maintained the family values. And it's not really the world that we live, like the thing that used to really bother me when I used to live in London, mm-hmm, is that like everybody's got headphones on, like they're constantly, you know, they're either, and the headphones is because they're either on the phone or they're listening to music. They just don't want to have to think, they don't want to have to get into their heart, they just want to be constantly distracted. And so everybody just walks around like a zombie.
So it's fascinating that you mentioned
everybody's
that.
Everybody's so cool. Everybody, you know, everybody thinks that they're so cool because they've got these white AirPods in their ears. Yeah. Right. And you're so hip and you're so fashionable. Mm-hmm. Right. And you're so happening. But in reality, you don't realize how much you're killing yourself because you're just expanding the nerves more and more.
Yeah. So it's fascinating that you mentioned that, because what I would call them, and the term that I use for them, is crutches. So they're crutches essentially that people lean on because they don't have anything else, yeah, and they're dependent, yeah, upon it. So yeah. I was speaking with a customer today actually at the shop, and he was talking about gym and how he needs a pre-workout before doing a workout. Because he needs it to get amped and to hit his maximums.
And the gym is just another crutch.
So the gym is another crutch, but what I'm talking about is that he is unable to perform at peak performance just based off, I guess, nafs alone. Just based on pure determination, he is unable to hit his maximum because he has relied on this crutch. Does that make sense? So what's happening is a lot of people, for some people it's music. They can't have a gym workout without a music, for example.
Mm.
And because of that, and the example I said to him is, so if you're in the street and you're going to have a fight, right? Do you then pull out a pre-workout or do you then put your AirPods in? Like that's not how the world works. You don't.
Yeah,
you
imagine society collapses tomorrow, right? And you've got to go and hunt deer, and you've got a bear about to attack you in the woods, and you're like, can you just hold on a minute? I need to have a pre-workout and my protein milkshake, and then we can do this.
Yeah, so
it's not gonna happen.
So because of these crutches, I used to do this thing where I used to go on jogs, but I would not take any headphones, and I would just go on a jog to be with myself. And to just, I guess, exist. And it was more of a keeping my mind in check. And I guess another person that might be really good at this is actually David Goggins. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Because he's just a machine. He's managed to, I guess, without being spiritual, but he's managed to control it. He basically says he can exist in the most uncomfortable positions just because he wants to, if that makes sense. So he can put himself in hard situations, and he's done it time and time again.
That's mastery, though.
But
like, that's majesty, outward majesty. So majesty, the definition, if you want to understand majesty, like when a horse is majestic, it's just so much in control of itself. It can just, you know, it can plod along and it can tiptoe or whatever. When a horse is majestic, not only is it in full control, but you are like, you're just so like in awe of the thing. So, it just has complete command on itself. That's majesty. And so what you're describing there is majesty. And that's what men like Ertugrul had. They had majesty, right? They're not getting rattled by somebody misbehaving with them or disrespecting them.
Yeah.
They're not afraid of somebody attacking them, right? And they're in control of themselves.
That's funny, because there was one time a customer came inside the shop And it was a white rich man. You could tell. Now, I was, at the first time, I was just calling it. It was a white rich man confidence, right? Mm. But really, that person was unbothered. When he walked in the room, you could feel that this person was unbothered by anything.
Majesty. Like,
so that's fascinating. That word, that makes more sense now.
Yeah, you know what the Western world likes to call charisma.
Yes.
Right.
Oh,
charisma you can manufacture, because you can put on a nice tie, and you can there's a charm that you can give people fake compliments, and you can kind of manufacture charisma in that way, right?
Yeah.
But majesty is much more natural. Yeah. It doesn't matter what, I mean, it helps, obviously it will always help if you wear a nice suit and all that kind of stuff. But majesty is something that your heart emits, that other people just kind of tune into, that they recognize that there's a certain force here without you actually doing anything. It just becomes your state. Now, the more separation and gathering you do, the more these firmer updates that you get, the more of what increases is inward beauty and outward majesty. Beauty on the inside, right, is, but you know, like when you look at a Ferrari, it's really beautiful. There's a certain satisfaction in looking at it.
Yes.
Right. Or if you go on Hajj and you look at the Kaaba, right, there's a certain satisfaction in it. Right. That's beauty. So what happens is, as your inward beauty increases, your inward satisfaction is increasing. Right. Because the more you're connecting to Allah, the more your thirst is being quenched, the more you're being satisfied. So then outwardly, nothing actually satisfies you. You're not actually satisfied by a ride in a Ferrari, you're not satisfied by a holiday, you're not, because those things are pale in comparison to the satisfaction you're experiencing inwardly. So you lose interest in them, and not in a monk kind of way. It's just that they have no pull on you.
Yeah,
right.
It's happening where people are trying to fill themselves with the dunya.
Yeah,
and they can't fill themselves with the dunya because it could never be enough.
It will never be enough, because the nafs is never going to get satisfied. If you do that on the outside, what happens is you create darkness on the inside. You move more and more away from Allah. If you gather yourself to material things, the more you covet the car and the house and all those kind of things, right, beyond necessity, right, or that's all you're attached to, what it does, it creates more and more darkness in the heart. When you're doing that, you're also feeding the nafs. So the nafs is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bigger it gets, the more veils you get. The more veils you get, the more anxieties you get. The more anxieties can be of many, many different natures. It can be depression. It can be schizophrenia. It can be just fear. It can be terror. It can be whatever. It's stress, whatever it is. You just get more and more of these. And then they manifest in lots of different ways. They can manifest in, okay, you just become bitter towards people because you're actually afraid of them. Or your nervous system starts to let you down, and your arm stops working, or so many, many different ways, right? So the key is to lower, keep lowering the nafs, and that's done by just gathering. When you gather the heart in, when you gather yourself inwardly, that light that comes in, it starts to reduce the nafs. It starts to bring it down and down and down.
So a lot of people, I think they don't credit. So the idea of having tawakkul, for a lot of people, when people say have tawakkul, they don't necessarily understand. They just see it as trust in Allah. But without understanding what the impact it can have, or what kind of strength it is, right?
Yes.
So just to explain what kind of strength it is, and I this is an exercise that I always do when I think about tawakkul, which is there was a war that happened with the Sahabas where they were, if I'm correct, it was 10-1 ratio of people. Well, I think they had 10,000 warriors, and they were going up against 100,000. I believe it was the Persians against the Persians and the Romans. And one of the strategies, I was watching a video of a white lecturer actually talking about this.
I know which one you're talking about.
It's the one where he compresses them, like 50,000 people. They compress them and they keep attacking them in a way that
Khalid bin Walid. They actually had less men, and then he sent them down like these bridges or something. Because you could only combat 1-1, they would win the 1-1 combats, and they just keep finishing their men off, basically.
Well,
they didn't attack en masse, but the other side couldn't attack en masse.
So they become so compressed that they were unable to move. So they were just getting picked off. I think it was 50,000 people that they got at once. 10,000 people attack 50,000 people at once. So this is a quantifiable proof of what the power of tawakkul is. right?
Yeah.
It was the ability for an army of 10,000 people to, and the numbers might be incorrect, but the proportions are similar, of 10,000 people to take on a fight of 100,000 people, right? So that's just one physical way of showing what the power.
Yeah, but there's so many other ways as well. But the thing that I leave you with, because this is being I want to keep the, because people can listen to the recording.
Yeah.
But one thing that I will say is that when you have this when you're doing the separation and gathering and you're building yourself up inwardly, right? You're gathering inward knowledge, right? You have inward action, right?
Right.
That will manifest outwardly. But if you only have outward knowledge, right? So you collect all the hadith, and you memorize the Quran, and you do as many nafal as you can or whatever, and they all have their place. I'm not saying that they don't. But when you're only in the place of outward knowledge, you cannot act. You can only act when you have inward knowledge. You can only act when you've mastered the heart. Because when you only have the outward, you're going to end up in situations, but you don't know how to. You just don't know how to face them. You have an inability to face them because your heart gets paralyzed. Right, so until you can master the heart, you actually are not capable of acting. And when I say about acting, you're not actually capable of amal. All you're doing is you're just collecting knowledge. You're just collecting content. You can't do anything with it.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I'll give you the perfect example of it. Right, so you can get a highway code booklet. You can get a brochure on a car. And you can even bring the car home and park it in the driveway. And the person reads the highway code. They read everything there is to know about the highway code. They know everything there is to know about traffic lights, lane markings, and every traffic rule under the sun. They've memorized the entire thing. So they've got the knowledge on the highway code, right? Then what they do is they get the brochure on the car, and they get a manual on the car. And they know everything there is to know about the car. So they know how much boot capacity it has. They know what engine capacity it has, what fuel it takes, what tire pressure should be, when the car was manufactured. They know everything there is to know about the car, right? So this is knowledge in the way that what the world tells us what knowledge is supposed to be, right? It rote memorization. But you put that person in the car, right? And they're not able to drive that car because nobody's actually taught them how to actually drive. They don't have the experience of driving. They get to the bottom of the road, right, they see a car coming towards them, they freak out, right, and they just pull up into the corner, they get out of the car, and they go running home and crying because they're so afraid. They know everything there is to know about the car, but they can't drive the thing. They don't have the courage or the confidence to do it. And that's the world we're living in right now. We're just being taught all of this stuff intellectually, but none of it is learning for us to actually master it. We don't actually know how to drive.
Yeah. And the same can be seen across the board. I mean, food critics who can't cook, people who criticize fights can't fight for themselves.
Yeah, everything. I see videos of like these kids that are getting celebrated because this kid knows how to spell the longest word in the dictionary or something, or you can spell a thousand different words. It's of no use to him. Because if he cannot have the courage to say, okay, well, like you said, that he doesn't have the resolve to see something through, it's completely pointless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I think, and again, it comes down to, you know, Elon Musk has started his school at Astra. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And
no.
He teaches. So the concept that he said inside his video regarding it was that he gives the child a spanner and he'll put him in a room where there's a nut that needs to be loosened or tightened, right? And they've got to go and do it, and then they've got to build that connection that this is what that's meant to do. Does that make sense? By doing as opposed to just telling them wrenches are used for nuts. So
thing with Elon Musk is that the problem with him is the guy's a major opportunist, and the problem is that he's learned how to be. He's very good at branding. He's very good at making people think he's really intelligent and he's really smart and he's here to change the world. But a lot of what he does is just playing games, right? Yeah. So he will announce Hyperloop and say, but the only reason he's actually announced Hyperloop is because he wants to derail the Californian train project. Because if that goes ahead and people start using public transport, he won't be able to sell any Teslas. So he does that a lot. He pretends to be really smart. He takes the credit for other people and passes
he's an interesting character. With the Ad Astra thing, I think it was fascinating because that was For me, I went through the school system. I didn't go to university. And I think going to university would have actually neutered me in a way.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely no surprise to me that you said to me that you didn't go to university because you're so much better for it.
I got
what did it for me in my 20s was entrepreneurship. I got thrown into entrepreneurship when I was like 18. And so even though I went to university, it was a massive contrast.
Yeah. Again, university is all about, you get all these guys with business degrees, can't do anything.
They don't have a business. They don't have the confidence. They don't have the confidence. They don't have the wisdom. Yes. The big difference between wisdom and knowledge. Uh-huh. But listen, I think we should wrap it up there, inshallah.
Yep. Yeah, inshallah.
It was a fascinating discussion.
It was. It's always good speaking to yourself.
Well, that was a wrap. I hope you enjoyed this particular episode on the When Men Were Men podcast. If you have any thoughts, if you want to send in anything that you thought about this particular episode or any previous episode, you can actually go to the anchor.fm website and send in a voice message. So if you're listening to this on the app, just click the voice message button and send in your voice message of your thoughts. A minute, 2 minutes, whatever you want to say, whether you disagree with something, whether you agree with something, just your general thoughts, whatever they might be, feel free to send those in. Obviously, keep it civilized. I can't believe I have to say this in this day and age. Let's have some civilized discourse about this. And if you'd like to learn more about me, if you can go to either the anchor.fm/Khurram Malik, that's Khuram hyphen Malik, that's probably where some of you are already listening to this. You'll see the link to my website. If you don't, if you're listening to this somewhere else, then you can go to krmmalik.com, which is K-R-M-M, that's two M's, A-L-I-K.com. And on there, you'll have all contact details for me. If you want to get in touch, or if you know somebody that should be on this show with me, then let's talk about that.